is McClure, as you can see here, and he's got a coat also, quote, Lisa Stiff. He's from Seattle, PI. He grew up in Florida, spent his first 39 years there before celebrating his 40th birthday camping at Mount Adams as a new resident of Washington. He's covered environmental affairs with an emphasis on natural resources for 2 decades in Florida and Washington, and he likes it here. So this morning he's going to tell us, he's a Seattle PI reporter, of course, he's going to tell us about Puget Sound. This is an article that he put together in the PI, which I did about 50 copies of there. So on the way out, we're going to get this, pick it up. If we run out, we can probably get more. So, and it's on, I guess, on the web as well. So this is an example of his work and then from the Puget Sound. So he's been for 6 years on the PI and examining the plight of Puget Sound and analyzing efforts to save it. And he's basically going to tell us the story this morning. So, Robert.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it very much. You're doing well already. Thanks for making me one of your seven talks that you wanted to see. Sorry about that. Yeah, I thought I'd spend about half an hour I'm really glad to be here as a guest of the Water Center. I think it's a really interesting and special collaboration, and so I'm thrilled to be able to help a little bit. I was going to tell you about basically two reporting efforts that basically bookend what we've done so far dealing with the health of Puget Sound and the Duwamish River, kind of how we did them and a little bit about what we found. There should be plenty of time for Q&A at the end, so interrupt me as I'm going along if you don't understand something, and then afterwards we'll have Q&A and we can have a dialogue, whatever you'd like to talk about. And at that point, I mean, we can talk about anything you want. You can ask me about anything you'd like. I've also reported on the Everglades and energy and endangered species and various things that don't begin with E. So about 6 years ago, my boss's boss's boss was sitting at the PI. We're right there in Elliott Bay. So the editors all meet at this big long table called the bullpen, and so they basically look out on Puget Sound twice a day. And the managing editor, David McCumber, he said, "Gee, I wonder what the status of Puget Sound's health is." And that actually sort of almost an offhand question led to a lot of intense reporting for the last 6 years. And my co-author for much of this has been Lisa Stifler, whose name is on here, the initial reporting project, this one, which we've run out of reprints for. It was called Our Troubled Sound. And so she was the main co-author, although there were others who worked on it as well, Margaret Sancher, Lisa Olson, and some others. So I thought I would tell you just a little bit about how we came to do the reporting project on Puget Sound, and then what we found and how that led to this last year's reporting effort on the Duwamish River. We spent about 6 months very intensely spent a lot of time with scientists, but also government policymakers, environmentalists, business people. I'm sure I'm leaving out some. Basically trying to assess the health of Puget Sound. It shouldn't be a surprise that in a place with a big military-industrial complex that we have around Puget Sound, that we have just an enormous amount of pollution. A lot of it's out there in the sediments. It's just from historic dumping. But we also found out that there's ongoing pollution, and it has to do with really the way we all live our lives. One of the things we did was we went out with Department of Fish and Wildlife scientists who drag a big net through Puget Sound, and then they pull out the catch, and they figure out exactly what was in the catch, and they do this on a systematic basis. And what we found at that time, and I think this is still largely true, is that about half of the biomass they were pulling out of the sound was ratfish. That's what fishermen would call a trash fish. But it's something that's exploited the niche that's been left behind by overfishing. It's just become because of overfishing and other problems, the sound is endangered, and a lot of the biomass is now ratfish. And as I mentioned earlier, everyone's contributing to the problems now. One of the biggest problems is stormwater. And stormwater, we'll talk about a little bit more in a little while, but that's basically every time it rains pretty hard, we get a big flush of pollutants washing off the streets into the waterways. And obviously this affects creatures, but it also affects people because people are eating the shellfish and other fish from the Sound. One thing we found out about is that, again, on the problem of stormwater, this is a fish that's being tested. It's a little small salmon. At very minute concentrations, copper can make this. This experiments have shown that copper can make little salmon unable to smell, and this is important for a variety of reasons. But one of the most important ones is that they have this really interesting way of using smell to know when there's a predator in the area, and that is that when one little one gets chomped, this smell goes out in the water, and all the other little salmon around there smell that and go, predator, I got to scram. So copper interferes quite a bit with their ability to smell as young fish. This is Longfellow Creek in West Seattle, and right around this time of year, every year we get the first good flush of rain flushing stuff into the streams. And we discovered that, in fact, salmon were coming up Longfellow Creek to spawn. And what happens is they hang out there waiting for that first flush of fresh water to come out. And then they know fresh water's coming out of the stream. It's time to go spawn. So they go up. And they know there's going to be enough water from then on for the eggs to hatch. Well, they were going up during this first flush of stormwater and actually dying. The pollution that is ongoing, as I mentioned. This is all of the different entities that have a permit from the Department of Ecology to dump water pollution into the water. Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. Theoretically, it was going to end water pollution in America by 1985, which might have been a little bit ambitious, we now know. But the way it's been implemented has been problematic. The whole idea was that if you're a sewage treatment plant or you're a factory or something like that, you would have to get this permit, and every 5 years you'd have to renew it. And the idea was that by the time 5 years rolled around, we'd have better ways of controlling whatever gunk it is you're putting into the water. And so you're supposed to ratchet down the pollution levels over time. And theoretically, by 1985, we would be having no pollution. So you can see the sheer volume of pollution, of polluters. I think the green ones are these are color coded. So green ones are heavy metals. The yellows that show up too well here is dioxin and phenols. PCBs, there's very few that are permitted to do that. And then the red ones are basically lots of other forms of pollution. The problem that's happened is that oftentimes the regulatory agencies, the Department of Ecology here, fails to actually make a facility renew their permit after 5 years. And so it might go on for maybe 10 years. And even then, they don't always ratchet down the pollution levels. So we explored that some in the Puget Sound series. There's more than 900 of these around the Sound. PCBs are still being released in just a few places. But they are still permitted. I think the Nucor steel plant on the Duwamish is one. I think the Naval Shipyard over in Bremerton is one. And these are places that were so thoroughly polluted by PCBs. And we can talk more about that later if you want more on PCBs. But they were so thoroughly polluted historically that they can't quite get it out of the water that's draining off of there. But we found it remarkable that they were actually permitted to do that still, since PCBs were banned in 1977. And then I think I mentioned that the permits often expire, and so therefore the mechanism to control the pollution isn't working. A lot of the worst problems are in sort of small towns, these foothill towns like Granite Falls would be an example, that are growing pretty rapidly but are not expanding their sewage treatment capacity. And we even found state government, the worst example of that was there's a park out on Blake Island where they take tourists and there's sort of an Indian feast dance type thing. Well, we found out that they were, you know, and they are really excited about how beautiful Puget Sound is, and that sort of they extol the virtues of Puget Sound during this presentation, but we found that they were, at the time, dumping raw sewage into Puget Sound. And since we reported on that, they did fix that. This is another look at, this is about not just who's dumping, but who's actually violating the rules. So if you're a factory or a sewage treatment plant, you have certain limits of a concentration of pollutants that can be in the water you're dumping. And the larger circles represent the ones that had more violations. Typically every month they send something into the Department of Ecology. Department of Ecology may or may not look very closely at that, as we found. But they did. These are the ones that they did catch and issue violations for. Or actually, I think it's been a while, but I think we actually looked over some of the data ourselves and realized there were violations that weren't being cited. I think that's what this reflects. PCBs, I mentioned earlier, they were used as a coolant, as an anti-inflammatory agent. Mostly in electrical equipment for a long time. That stuff's all over. We have Puget Sound is pretty polluted by PCBs in certain industrial areas, and that has worked its way out into the into the food chain. And this is a graphic that we ran, which basically tells you which kinds of fish are highest in PCBs at various places around Puget Sound. We mentioned stormwater. I'm forever indebted to Paul Joseph Brown, who's been the photographer on both of these projects I'm talking about today, because stormwater is one of these things. It is the largest ongoing threat to Puget Sound, and that's because of urbanization. The more that we build hard surfaces and get rid of the old Doug fir forest with the duff at the bottom that used to soak up a lot of that water, the more water runs off. And Paul got this photo that I thought really just captured. That's the stuff that's going in the Puget Sound, and you can tell from looking at it that it's filthy. There are ways to control stormwater pollution. This is something that was done in North Seattle, and basically you can see they took a street that was a nice straight street with parking swales on either side, and they turned it into this sort of curvy thing with rain gardens, what they call rain gardens, at the edge. And those are special swales that soak up rainwater. It's quite expensive to go out and retrofit a residential block like that, as you can imagine. But it looks really great, and so we were just showing how this is done. This is sort of how the this is a cutaway there, and then this is the top view of what they're doing. But basically the plants are soaking up the water, and the pollution is falling out into the soil. This has not been done in many places. I just had a story in yesterday's paper about how in South Lake Union, Vulcan, Paul Allen's company, is teaming up with the city to put... this is something you can do sort of in North Seattle where you have grassy streets and things, but the real challenge is, you know, when you have really close-packed, hard-pan city. And they're actually going to build these 10-foot-wide swales. If you know where the REI, the mothership is, it's right down the street from there. Vulcan's redeveloping, and it's a pretty cool... I actually wish I'd thrown it in here. Sorry, I didn't think of it until now. About 10-foot-wide swales to take this water, slow it down, and let the pollutants settle out. I mentioned overfishing. A lot of the overfishing had basically taken place by the time we started looking into this. Some pretty bad things happened in the 80s, having to do with the Department of Fish and Wildlife deciding that, gee, we're not doing so well on salmon, but you know, we've kind of fished the runs pretty hard, so they started encouraging anglers to go out and catch rockfish. Well, they didn't really understand the biology of rockfish at the time, and the fact that they're long-lived and they don't reproduce until they get to be about as old as a human is when we start to reproduce. So DFW encouraged people to target these. They took a whole lot of them out, and they're having a lot of trouble rebounding. That story is about vanishing fish can be told and about various species. For the next 5 years or so, Lisa and I made it our business to write continuously about Puget Sound and to basically try to spur the government and everyone to do better by Puget Sound. There's a number of stories we did. Governor Locke, sort of half-heartedly, and then Governor Gregoire, in a much bigger way, called for an urgent reform campaign to start cleaning up Puget Sound. There's something that's been formed now called the Puget Sound Partnership, and it's kind of an odd bird of a state agency that the legislature put together to try to get everyone moving forward together. More of a carrot than a stick approach, and we've written about that. So that's what's going on. We also became aware that, I guess about the same time we did the original Puget Sound project, the Duwamish River down in South Seattle. So if you're on the viaduct, you can see the gantry cranes. So it's the big orange gantry cranes. It's just beyond that big industrial section. It was where the original truck farms were that supplied vegetables to the original Pike Place market back early last century. Italian farmers and other immigrant farmers were working there. That was industrialized over the first half of the last century. And by about the time we started on the Puget Sound project, it had been declared a Superfund site. And as you may know, the Superfund program was created in the early 1980s after some pretty horrendous toxic incidents occurred Love Canal in New York. There's the Pines Beach in Missouri and Valley of the Drums in Kentucky, places like that. And what that means is, if once something's put on the Superfund list, it means it is one of the nation's worst toxic messes. That had happened in the Duwamish, and sort of quietly largely behind closed doors, the government and the federal government, the EPA, was working with the Port of Seattle, Boeing, the City of Seattle, and King County, who all had polluted the river in various ways, to come out with what they were, basically their statement of the problem. How bad is the pollution of the Duwamish River? And recognizing that opportunities for public involvement in this process are they're discreet, let's put it that way. I've said they're limited, and I guess the people in the government upset, you know, but the point is that last November there was going to be a public meeting by EPA where people could come in and critique these polluters' statement of the problem. And that's important because the statement of the problem is what, and that's called a remedial investigation, is the basis for what they call the feasibility study, which to translate is, that's the cleanup plan. So we, I worked on this with Colin McDonald, a young reporter who was at the paper for a little while. Lisa was off doing something else on this, so this was something that Colin and I did together. So knowing that important public meeting was coming up, we decided that we would do a pretty thorough investigation of what was going on. And I'm going to move pretty quickly through this, but there are these reprints, if you would like to see in some detail what we did. And Bob mentioned that it's on the web. There's also some extras on the web, like there's a slideshow and there's some audio interviews and things like that. We also have, this is also, the Puget Sound series is also on the web, if you're interested in seeing more. I'm going to move quickly here because we want to leave time for questions. So that meeting was scheduled on November 29th. So we had a really hard deadline. It had to run. We had a three-day series and it had to run 26th, 27th, and 28th. The slide says last opportunity for public comment for more than a year. It's going to actually turn out to be like a year and a half because the schedule has slipped. We were gratified to see, you know, they were expecting maybe 100 people at the meeting and there was 350 or something. So it felt like we actually got across some stuff to people. Now, one of the things about this is that what these polluters are doing, and the polluters, again, with the exception of Boeing, and they are almost this way, you know, they represent all of us, But so what we, it's a very complicated process that they go through to sort of evaluate for each animal what the threats are. And I looked into this in some detail and came to the conclusion that they were probably underestimating the risks for some of the animals. And I did this by looking at largely at what the National Marine Fisheries Service had written to the Environmental Protection Agency to say in critiquing this statement of the problem. And so I was trying as a reporter to get across to people why you know, sort of in a shorthand, what's wrong with this? Well, one of the things that I found was that there was a study that had been done by some scientists in Oregon, and they had looked down there, but they'd also looked at otters in Puget Sound. And one of the things they found out is that otters exposed to the chemicals that we're talking about in the Duwamish River, male otters have smaller penises, and they have, they're less able to reproduce. So the bottom line for me, so that's how I kind of focused, I latched onto that one study and the fact that they hadn't actually paid attention to that. Because that's a lot of what I do, is take complicated stuff and try and boil it down so people understand it. And so the story, this story here, rivers, risk to rivers, fish and wildlife underestimated, starts out, an otter pokes its head above the water, checks out a gaggle of passing kayakers, and then swish, disappears. He descends back into a world of arsenic, copper, lead, mercury, and zinc, a place of tributyl tin, polychlorinated biphenyls, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and bis-2-ethylhexylphthalate. All that and more are at the bottom of the Duwamish River, especially where the river otter surfaced in front of 2 8-by-10-foot discharge pipes on the river's east bank, a scant half mile from the West Seattle Bridge. So I was trying there to get people interested in the otter, and eventually as they read the story, they find out about this study that had been ignored. And I tried to tell people that it was close to the West Seattle Bridge because, you know, think of how many people drive across that thing every day. Many of them don't even realize there's a river down there. So I was trying to bring that home to people, that this is a pretty bad pollution problem right in the heart of our city. I think I mentioned that a lot of what I do is read a lot of government documents and file public records requests to get government documents. And one of the most revealing things that I have found is to get the correspondence between agencies or between an agency and a polluter and sort of see what they're saying to each other. And in the case of this Duwamish one, the National Marine Fisheries Service was just hammering EPA over some of the issues, saying you're understating risks here. And once I had read these documents, then I went to the scientists who had been writing this at the National Marine Fisheries Service, and those folks spoke with me, and I thought were very helpful. And EPA, I mean, I should say, you know, there's a lot of really good people working at EPA, and they're trying to do their best. It's a hard job because there's so much pollution that's been there for so long, and there's a lot of questions about how much we can really clean it up. Briefly, because I don't want to go on for too long, this is Guy Crow. He runs the South Park Marina, which is right next to a place that used to be the old Malarkey asphalt plant. And he had an interesting story. A lot of what we try to do is get out and talk to people who are affected by this. And we found that government is not always listening that closely. In his case, this asphalt plant had closed next door. It had been supposedly cleaned up. And he was interested in expanding, so he started negotiating with the Port of Seattle to buy the land. And he hired a lawyer and spent about $10,000 putting down an offer. And, you know, then he would then go out and get financing. Well, while this offer was pending, he sees this unusual thing. This van pulls up. It's one of the environmental services companies. And these two technicians get out, and they're walking around on the property over there. And this is the property he would like to buy, so he's watching. And they're poking around in the ground somewhere, and all of a sudden they sort of stop. And then they not walk, but sprint back to their vehicle and put on moon suits, and then come out and keep doing their work. Well, he found this curious, and About a week later, he got a voicemail message from the Port of Seattle saying that the property was no longer for sale. So I recounted this in this series. I never got a good answer from the Port of Seattle as to why they, you know, what was going on. They said there was no connection between the two, but I just let my readers decide about that. We know that there's going to be cleanup of the Duwamish River. There has to be. It's a Superfund site. There's a process that provides for that. The question is, to what degree will it be cleaned up? And what we see setting up is a, what I could tell is happening is that the folks, the four agencies, and, or three agencies in Boeing, are positioning themselves to argue that it would cost so much to clean up the river to the point that people could actually fish there on a regular basis for subsistence, that it just isn't worth it. And I think roughly the numbers are, and these are moving targets, so don't hold me to this, but it's like if you're going to clean up the PCBs to, it's like a curve, but basically you know, it goes like this. So the more you know, the more you spend going this way, the lower the PCB level goes. But then it kind of plateaus, and it's a long way before it starts going down any further. But it plateaus above the level where people can safely eat from the river on a regular basis. So that's going to be a big question. Is the public willing to pay the other $400 million or something, or who knows how much, in order to get it to where people could actually fish there? This is a Muckleshoot tribal fisherman who's catching salmon out there. Salmon is the only thing in the Duwamish that's considered safe to eat. I went through that pretty fast, so that's it. That's what I had to say for now. And I'm happy to take questions, talk about Duwamish, Puget Sound. I guess I have to do my little commercial too. We have a blog, Lisa and I. Lisa's on maternity leave right now, so I have a blog right now. It's called DatelineEarth.com, and we cover a lot of topics in there. So I encourage you to check that out if you want to sort of dip into some of the stuff that we're doing in bite-sized chunks. That's fun. Yesterday I wrote about the Everglades, which I covered a lot when I was living in Florida. We do a lot on alternative energy. And endangered species and a lot of other things. So if I can talk to anybody has questions or wants to discuss how I do my job or any topic stuff, fire away. Sure.
I have a question about state agencies. I know that the Duwamish area has a lot of non-native English speakers. And what kind of translation is going on for these people so they know what we know that's not English out of that area?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sure, there's a lot. The question was in terms of state agencies, there's a lot of people around the Duwamish who are not native English speakers. And I think the thrust of the question was to what degree are there efforts being made to make sure that they understand that eating the shellfish is, eating any of basically anything out of there is not a good idea. There's been efforts made over the years to do that. And there's a group called the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, which is it's a coalition of sort of small business groups, environmentalists, tribal interests, and others. And they're playing kind of an interesting role at most Superfund sites. The agencies and the polluters look over a bunch of documents, and then they sort of present it to the public. In this case, they're actually allowing the DRCC to see the stuff as it's being produced. Anyway, the DRCC has been having public meetings, and they have provided translation. To be honest, I don't think a lot of Hispanic people are coming out to that of those. I don't think a lot of Asian and Pacific Islanders are coming out to those. The state in the past had made some efforts to get to those groups through sort of other channels. I don't know how much of that's going on right now. There are signs out there. They're not as numerous as they used to be, from what I can tell, that are in Spanish and several other languages.
Is your article translated into any other languages?
It is not, no. That's a good point. I mean, how are we going to get the word out? The other thing about journalism that's kind of frustrating is, you know, the story's out there for a day, and then it's fish wrapper, which is why we did these reprints. And these were down at the aquarium, for the, you know, during the summer where people could pick them up. I bring them to places like this. But, you know, this is getting the people who are already interested and kind of self-selected. So you make a good point. That word needs to get out better, and we probably could help with that. Anything else?
I guess the question is, what are the cleanup methods going to be, and what
are the... Have you done any research into the effectiveness or the repercussions of...
Sure. A lot of the problem in the Duwamish is that there are pollutants in the sediments, in the soil at the bottom of the river. And so, basically, the remedy is probably going to be, in most places, to go dig that stuff up and take it upland and do something to neutralize whatever the contaminants are that are in there. And is it effective? Well, they have these places that they call early action sites. So it's really the places that they know are just the yuckiest of the yucky. And they are attempting to clean those up first and then decide for this more diffuse pollution, how much of the river do you want to dredge and how much is coming downstream. So one of the earliest ones they did was a place called the Duwamish Diagonal. There's two big pipes that I referred to that the auger was in front of. That's bringing in a mix of stormwater and at times raw sewage into the river, and it's done that for years. And so they went out to dredge in front of there again. You know that's bad, so let's get to that first. The problem was that the dredging was done in a pretty sloppy way by a contractor that went too fast. And you can imagine, you're going down with a big old bucket to the bottom of a river, picking up muck, bringing it up, and you know, if you go too fast, you're gonna lose some stuff out the side. And that's exactly what happened. The Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition had warned the authorities that, hey, you know, you need to use a different dredging method, and if you're gonna go with this one, there are other ways to do this that are, they think, better. Kind of suction dredges and things like that that don't involve so much throwing around dirty materials. Anyway, when all was said and done, they'd gotten a lot of pollution out of the river, but they had also spread a lot of the pollution around. And the lesson there was, you need to think carefully about the remedy because you don't want to make it worse. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Are they actually going to listen to that, or are they?
We'll be watching to find out, won't we? That's why I live, and that's my reason for living. Yeah.
I'm a reporter. Are your articles subject to much editing by your editors, or is there any layer of censoring or not censoring, but possibly censoring going on once you write an article? Will you write as it actually gets printed?
That's a good question, and I hear it a lot. I've been doing this since, the late 70s. And I have yet to see what I would call censoring. It hasn't happened to me, hasn't happened to people I know. I know there's this perception in a lot of that goes on, and I've only worked in, a handful of newsrooms, so I can't tell you what goes on, but it doesn't happen to me. I will tell you that in something like the Duwamish or the Puget Sound series, we go over those quite a bit, and they do get changed quite a bit, and that's the process of journalism, and that's fine. Never in a way that I would not. We basically want to make the case. We want to make our case, and so an editor's there to say, "Well, maybe you've gone too far with this. This isn't backed up." And then we pull back. We reword. Maybe we go out and ask some more questions, or we get some more documents. So that process of editing that goes on a big project like this is very helpful. I think I have a story in this morning's paper that's very lightly edited, because we found out at about noon yesterday that the National Nature Research Service had issued this, what they call a biological opinion. It's a decision by them that said that basically there needs to be a moratorium on building in floodplains near rivers, and that's a fairly large deal for them to come out and say that. And so between midday yesterday and 6 o'clock yesterday when the story was due, I had to, you know, theoretically read this 200-some page document, which of course I couldn't do, but I read as much as I could, and interview a bunch of people. And so when I, you know, filed the story, actually at 6:15, so a little late past deadline, it was very lightly edited. So those are kind of the two ends of the spectrum there. But as far as censorship, I don't really see that. And, you know, I mean, I remember the paper I worked for in Fort Lauderdale, we ran this big story on how car lots were cheating their customers. And of course, you know, car lots were some of our biggest advertisers. And those guys came down really hard on the editor about that and wanted to retract that and, you know, say that we got it wrong, and he would not do that. And we lost a lot of ads. But of course they came back. But I've seen actually that there's that impression that a lot of censorship's going on. I haven't seen it.
How long does it take you to write these stories? Like this one in the magazine?
That a long time. The one yesterday, not very long at all. Maybe about an hour. I think the Duwamish thing we worked on, I think we started working on it in the summer. I started working on it full time in August, and we published in December. When I say full time, you know, there's a big news event, we have to drop that. But so as far as the writing itself, probably started around, I started in like late September, just scratching out some stuff. That's on a big project like that. That's really painful because there's massive amounts that you need to synthesize, and so we end up writing and rewriting and cutting lines up on the cutting room floor. But I guess we were probably in the writing phase for about 2 months on that project. But when we're writing, we're also still making phone calls. I mean, it tends up the thing where I come in the morning and report until 6 o'clock at night, and then right from 6 until 11. Or so, you know, that's pretty intense for about 2 months there. Yeah?
How did you get into journalism?
How did I get into journalism? There's a lot of ways to put that, but the best one, I'll just tell you, in eighth grade, I was in a journalism class at my junior high school. I had taken up the habit of cigarette smoking. And the professor was guy named, or the teacher was guy named Charlie Adams, who was virulently anti-smoking. And we had an assignment to write an editorial. And so my editorial was why we should be allowed to smoke across the street from school. And I came in and started, and he didn't know what I was going to write. So I came in and started reading my editorial, and by the end of the thing, he's going, "Go, Mosler, go, that's good." So anyway, he inspired me because, you know, even though he disagreed with me, it shows you the power of writing and reasoning and thought. So that's how I got into it. Since I was 13, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. Are we out of time? You got a cup up here? Yeah.
How do you settle in on a subject when there's so many issues?
You know, that's the question is, how do I settle in on a subject when there are so many issues? And that is the bane of my existence. Every day, there's 4 or 5 things that legitimately could be a story in the next day's newspaper. Since we've started writing the blog, sometimes something that we would like to write a story in becomes a quick blog item. And just briefly, this isn't a bright line, but basically, blog items are based on largely press releases, stuff that comes over the transom. And then stories, meaning in a story we're going to go out and we're going to actually interview people and try and get something like a fuller treatment. So the blog is basically, it calls people's attention to something, gives any perspective that we can offer, and links to things that will help them to understand the story more fully. So lately, a lot of stuff that I would like to do a story on goes to the blog. And then how do we decide what to do? Well, it's a hard thing. I mean, we found out about this ruling out of NIMS yesterday, this decision of NIMS. It's pretty clear that if we're calling for any kind of moratorium on building near rivers, that's pretty big news. So it's a news judgment. When we go and do something like the Duwamish or the Puget Sound, it's really painful because then there's a lot of stuff that we would like for people to know about that's happening on an ongoing basis. That we just, if we're going to get one of these larger looks done, we have to do it out. So it's a balancing act. Does that answer your question? There's not a good answer. Anyway, it's hard.
Do you have any formal environmental training, like environmental issues, or are you just kind of learning as you get new projects that you're interested
in? Until I went to, question, do I have formal environmental training? And the answer is sort of. I started doing this work, it depends on how you count it, but environmental journalism, somewhere between the mid-80s and late 80s. And finally, in the late 90s, I had a fellowship at the University of Michigan, where I did get some formal training. But before that, my actual, my last formal science training was eighth grade chemistry. You know, there is a requirement for science in high school, and I took a landscape architecture class that was sort of the equivalent of, you know, it's kind of like rockstar jobs. So I avoided science and then learned that I really needed to learn it. One thing that's been very helpful to me, and you should consider this if you're interested in journalism or the environment, is the Society of Environmental Journalists, SEJ.org. I think the first year membership is like, I think it might be 15 for students, but I think it's 20 for most people. If you're a student, you're eligible. If you're a student who's interested in environment and or journalism, you can join, and we have a great listserv, we have a quarterly journal. But that is a group of people that I can turn to really on a moment's notice, put something up in the listserv and say, I'm writing about tributyl tin today. Does anyone out there know much about this? And then if somebody else has written about it, they'll email me and I can get the benefit of their experience. So that's one of my best teaching tools for me.
Can you think of any particular times when you felt like you had a lot of influence on an issue? I know you mentioned the EPA meeting, but have there been times where you felt like the paper or an article that you wrote had a particular sort of a really powerful kind of influence on the public's awareness of an issue?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why I do it. there are a lot of examples. There are a lot of times I write about something that doesn't make a difference, but I mean, I did write very consistently and very early about the need for restoration of the Florida Everglades, which is at the moment the most ambitious environmental restoration project on the planet. It's not going very well, as I put in my blog yesterday, but Puget Sound. I don't think that this Puget Sound partnership would have been formed. Again, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if that's going to work, but I think the fact that we did that big series and then kept pounding, you know, away, you know, season after season after season, did have an impact. Sure, absolutely. There's another one back here somewhere.
I've heard that scientists are often a harder group for journalists to work with, and I was wondering if you've had what your experience is.
Yeah, the question is about whether scientists are a hard group for journalists to work with. And actually, I'm really interested in that question. I even attended a seminar with some of the leading scientists on climate change here at the university a couple of years ago to work on basically that problem. Journalists, I mean, a lot of them, like me, you know, they weren't that interested in math or science, right? So that's why they became journalists. We have to work on that. I personally really like hanging out with scientists now, but there's definitely different cultures, and you have to learn how to do that. So we are out of time.
Yeah, we are out of time.